Success isn't guaranteed. It's earned through unwavering commitment. The only ones who make it to the top are those willing to go the extra mile. Get ahead with WSJ Plus, offering insights from the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, MarketWatch, and Investor's Business Daily. Because fortune favors the ambitious.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom. When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
Welcome back to the podcast. Welcome back to our two-part series called Dieselgate 10, From Lies to Lithium. This is part two. If you missed part one yesterday, we tracked what happened with Defeat Devices, the software that made cars work differently when they were being tested to when they were being driven on the real world, why the world in 2015 thought diesel was the answer to the tightening emissions regulations around the world, and how Volkswagen's redemption resolution was a pivot to go EV. A reminder, our bonus shows are exclusively for our Patreon supporters for the first 7 days. Only Patreon insiders get early access. Get your name on the list of legends for $10 above a month. And the Power to Shape the Future shows. If that sounds like something you'd like to have a look at, check out Patreon, patreon.com/EVNewsDaily. No worries if not, because yeah, you just wait 7 days and it goes into the free feed anyway. So we left our story yesterday. The reputational damage of the big German automakers, VW took the hit, really, because they were the first ones to be discovered to doing this. But they were the ones that pivoted so hard and fast to EV within just over 12 months of being discovered of cheating. They unveiled their plan to take the company electric. And so today, in the second part, we talk more about what happened next and why the EV industry is where it is because of Dieselgate. The most immediate and profound market impact of the scandal was the collapse of diesel passenger car sales in the European stronghold. Consumer trust was shattered. Cities across the continent began proposing bans on old diesel vehicles to combat air pollution, eroding their resale value and appeal. The market data tells a stark story. In 2015, diesel sales were 52% of new car registrations in the entire European Union, of which we were part of at the time. So the UK was in those figures as well. Well over half. Some countries much, much higher than 52%. A decade later, by mid-2025, the share has plummeted now to just 9.5% on average. The rapid decline created a massive tech and market void. Automakers needed a new technology to meet these new emissions reductions targets. Electric vehicles, once a niche alternative, were the only technologically mature, politically acceptable long-term solution. Dieselgate did not invent the electric car, but Dieselgate cleared the path for its ascent by destroying its chief rival for the efficiency and compliance-focused regulations. What's the lasting legacy then of Dieselgate? Well, the decade following Dieselgate, we are marking 10 years to the week, by the way, since the EPA issued that fateful document, has been one of the most disruptive periods, possibly the most, in the automotive history. The crisis acted as an accelerant. It triggered a cascade of regulatory pressures, market forces, tech transformations that totally reshaped the industry that we talk about every day. The aftershocks of the 2015 deception continue to define the landscape today. The most direct and lasting legacy of Dieselgate was an overhaul of the emissions testing regulations, and they're still not perfect, by the way. Spot the way that China's CLTC numbers differ from WLTP to the EPA range estimates. There's no one globally agreed set of measurements and emissions testing, and the scandal exposed the glaring inadequacy of what was the existing lab-based test cycles, though. They were very predictable. They were highly outdated. And as we all found out, they were very easily manipulated. The public and political outcry destroyed the credibility of the old way of doing it, empowering regulators to be way more stringent and enact realistic protocols. Here in Europe, this led to the implementation of the worldwide harmonized light vehicle test procedure, WLTP, started in September 2017. The WLTP is a longer, more dynamic, more rigorous test cycle that reflects more modern driving conditions than the old NEDC, New European Driving Cycle, that it replaced. Crucially, the new framework introduced on-road testing using those portable emissions monitoring systems known as real driving emissions tests. So the old PEMs became RDE tests, which measures pollutants like nitrogen oxide under actual driving conditions, making a software-based defeat device impossible to implement. Well, at least a lot more difficult to implement. Beyond testing protocols, the scandal provided regulators with the political clout to pursue more ambitious long-term climate goals. The clear evidence of industry malfeasance and the public health impact of excess emissions, which is kind of the really dark side of what they were doing, created a powerful mandate for strong government oversight. The political momentum was a direct factor in the European Union's adoption of what they called Fit for 55. It was a climate package which legislated a 100% reduction in emissions for new cars and vans sold for 2055. Effectively, a phase out of all new internal combustion engine sales. In the United States, the settlement terms went way beyond financial penalties. It compelled Volkswagen to invest $800 million in zero-emission vehicle infrastructure and promoted projects in California, things like funding the transition that it had sought to avoid. Electrify America, whether it's been good to you or bad to you over the years, you wouldn't have been able to go EV at the speed at which the US went EV on such a massive landmass without that huge investment from Volkswagen in Electrify America. So how did EVs go from niche to mainstream? Well, this crackdown by the regulators back in the day and the collapse of diesel created a really fertile ground for exponential EV growth. What was a niche segment in 2015 became a mainstream force a decade later, a transformation starkly illustrated when you look at the figures. So in the European Union, 10 years ago this week, the BEV market share, pure BEV, was less than 1%. Now, the pure BEV, so not just plug-in, is overall 15.6%. But there's clearly countries that are way, way ahead. Diesel was 52% on average of the European new light vehicle sales. In the first 6 months of this year, it's 9.5%. Plug-in hybrids, well, they were about 1% as well. Now they're about 8.4%. So the total plug-in market is about 25% in the European Union in the first 6 months of 2025. Diesel, 9.5%. In the United States, it went from 0.7% to around 10%. And in China, 0.8%, and that's what they call NEVs, so that's plug-in hybrids and BEVs, to, well, it's about 49%, but on the regular EV News Daily podcast, I just talked this week about how the September figures are tracking to be almost a 60% plug-in month. 60%! Of China, the world's biggest auto market, where they're selling millions of EVs a month. It's crazy, the last 10 years in China. As the data shows, in Europe, the transition has been a direct replacement. So there's been a complete shift of diesel dropping, almost entirely absorbed by the rise of plug-ins. So in China, the effect was indirect but profound. While not a major diesel market, the global industry's post-Dieselgate pivot to EVs coincided perfectly with their Chinese strategic industrial policy set 10 years even before Dieselgate, when they realized they couldn't create the new Detroit. They couldn't create the new German EV market. They were never going to beat the established combustion makers with Chinese combustion engines. So what about a 20-year plan, they said in 2005, to be the world leader in EVs? We'll create battery electric technology. We will create supply chains. We have the raw materials. It's not worked out too badly 20 years later. They implemented aggressive NEV mandates and policy. The government implemented huge subsidies. They denied it to the day, whether that's cheap money or that's loans, that's banks keeping loss-making car companies afloat, regions and provinces keeping loss-making car companies afloat, just to keep the lights on in factories, massive overcapacity in China. As a result, though, the plug-in share has gone from 0.8, less than 1, to at least 50%. It's going to be more than 50% when the year shakes out. And in North America, the growth has been gradual but significant. The US EV market was 0.7% 10 years ago. Now it shakes out at around 10%. The expiration of the federal tax credits for new and used cars, I've seen people saying it's going to fall off a cliff. It totally won't. It, short term, the US will, you know, on October the 1st, people will not buy as many EVs as the day before, you know, because they're going to be more expensive. But we got rid of our grants in the UK, and Germany did as well. Germany really wobbled. We became much more resilient. The car makers had to compete without any kind of assistance. It shakes things out a little bit when you get rid of subsidies and incentives. Hey, I'm not saying I want to pay more for my EV. It kind of levels markets, makes people compete on features and quality of EV rather than, you know, which ones are under a certain price or batteries were from a certain place and get a certain amount of money off, and it skews markets. I'm not saying I want to pay more for EVs. I'll just repeat that. So I'm not convinced about this argument. The US is about to go through a dry patch. Do you know what I mean? I think it's gonna be a short-term impact. We'll wait and see. I'm optimistic. The new landscape after 2015 changed so quickly. The industry's frantic post-scandal race to electrify had unintended and, far-reaching consequences. The sudden massive demand for lithium-ion batteries created a gold rush for raw materials and manufacturing capacity to produce them. This played directly into the hands of the Chinese. They already had government support going for 10 years before this, and they already had a dominant position in the EV battery supply chain, from mineral processing to cell and pack manufacturing. Dieselgate, therefore, accelerated China's move to become the world's biggest EV maker. The shift also focused a fundamental change in the core competencies required to make an automotive product. The traditional strengths of the car makers, particularly the German firms, lay in complex mechanical engineering of engines and transmissions. The modern engine, the modern transmission, is a fabulous piece of engineering. The post-Dieselgate pivot to EVs rendered it all obsolete. The car of the future wasn't about the engine or its displacement or how many horsepower that engine could eke out. It was, what's the battery chemistry? Has it got a thermal management system? Oh, what kind of app has that vehicle got? The digital user experience? All of their smarts built up over 100 years? I didn't know what to do. The transformation forced so many established companies to create new divisions dedicated to software, see Cariad, and battery production, see PowerCo, fundamentally altering the business model from being a vehicle manufacturer, almost a final assembler when you have so many tier 1, tier 2, tier 3 suppliers, just-in-time arrival at your factory, that widget goes on that car. You're very good at assembling the widgets and making sure it all comes together at the right second, but you had to then suddenly become a system producer. You had to get vertically integrated. This singular moment of crisis in the car industry on focusing on BEVs as the future path to hit emissions regulations had the effect of sidelining all the investment in other low-carbon technologies, hybrids, hydrogen, synthetic fuels. Investments take 5, 10, 15, 20-year plans, and overnight they had to be rethought. So in the post-Dieselgate era, a decade after VW's deception was unveiled, and then many others in the industry as well, which forced the industry reluctantly to go electric, the automotive world finds itself at a critical point. The very regulations and market shifts that were a direct consequence of the scandal are now facing pushback from the same car makers who had to embrace them at the time. The final chapter of our saga is currently being written in the boardrooms and lobbying offices of Europe as we speak right now. There's never been a louder lobby in the last 10 years when the industry really kept its head down and wanted to just fix its reputation. There is so much hardcore lobbying going on right now for the 2030 and 2035 bans on pure emissions vehicles to be rethought, to be pushed back, for more leeway to be given, for the car makers to reopen their investment in combustion technology, because that's what they were really good at. How much of that is harking back to a past which simply doesn't exist anymore? The great pushback of questioning the 2035 mandate. It's a remarkable turn of events that over the last few months that I've been commentating on EV News Daily, all the big European automakers and their really powerful industry associations, whether that is the ACEA, European Automobile Manufacturers Association, Germany's VDA, all of the, even the local versions of around the country level lobby organizations, they're actively lobbying to weaken the 2035 emissions regulations. The emissions regulations in many places never spelt out how they had to be met. They simply said, you cannot keep emitting the way that you are doing, so find a solution. They never said, you have to go EV. It's the great lie told by the car industry in that, the regulators are forcing us to go EV. The Chinese are making EVs at these low, low costs because of access to very, low cost labor and cheap money from China and the banks and loans. And that if you make us go EV, we're going to lose the global. You'll lose a German auto industry. You'll lose the Detroit auto industry. The regulators have never said you have to go EV. They've just said work out new technologies that reduce the emissions. And EV is the answer. The only answer is EV. And so their arguments center on the challenges they face. They say there's not enough charging infrastructure. They say EVs cost too much for consumers. They say demand is softening. They say the Chinese are coming. Well, all of these facts may be true or not, but all of these arguments have really easy answers if only the politicians were educated enough and didn't roll over so easily in some cases. On the slow rollout of public charging infrastructure, yeah, Tesla thought that 10 years ago. They built their own. The high upfront cost of EVs for consumers? That's a lie. There are so many monthly deals now that are just exactly the same. They call it price parity with the combustion version. The cheapest new EV that I can buy here is the Dacia Spring, and it's now less than £12,000. It's about £11,990. As of recording today, it'll be cheaper tomorrow. That's for a brand new car, not a quadricycle, but a car that's not fabulously well-specced, but it's reliable, safe, electric transport, if that's what you need. Not pretending that we've all got 12 grand lying around under the sofa. It's £12,000 for a brand new car. And the monthly deals on those kind of cars that are around 16, 18, 20, £25,000 are competitive with anything else that you'd want to get into with an engine. Softening demand in some markets. That's just a lie. The markets and the car makers themselves set massive targets. Maybe during lockdowns and pandemic kind of gold rush into EVs. And so some of those very ambitious targets might not be met that they themselves set. And they position it in the media as a softening of the market. Now, maybe the growth rate is slowing down, but all markets that mature go at different speeds. So we enter this new market, this new world, where the Europe and China used to kind of be level pegging a few years ago. Now China is clearly out front. Like I said, the September's targeting almost 60% plug-in of their new car market. It's crazy. It never gets talked about enough. And they're heading towards, you know, Norway, Sweden figures. Like Sweden's about 60, some months, a bit more. Norway's at about 100%. And so China's heading that way. Europe's at about 25%. The US about 10%. We are splitting really into three big blocks of car buying people. And everyone's going to do it at different speeds. But nowhere's slowing down. So the car makers now advocate for what they call technology neutral approaches, which is let us get on with building cars, ease the regulations because it's too hard to do what you're asking us to do. Maybe we'll invest some more in plug-in hybrids. The latest greatest thing is that they're branding EREVs, E-R-E-V, extended range electric vehicles. Kind of came from China. Yeah, BMW did that with the Rex years ago. It's not new technology. They got a plug on the side. What defines an EREV really is having a massive battery, like 40, 50, 60 kilowatt hours and an engine that isn't linked to the wheel, so it's just a generator. But they can still sell engines. With batteries that big, why are you putting an engine in it? It's fine, you know. They're looking at e-fuels as the answer. The rhetoric from the top executives has shifted. BMW CEO Oliver Zipser labelled the 2035 ban, I quote, a big mistake. He argued that it ignores the full life cycle emissions of vehicles, that it unfairly penalises combustion engines. And the Stellantis CEO, he's been chipping in as well. They've got a great bunch of cars they'll sell you, but he's not arguing for you to buy one of those EVs. I'll tell you what he said in a moment. We'll take a break and come back in a moment for the final part of Dieselgate 10. Welcome back to the podcast. So, in our concluding part of our Dieselgate 10 investigation into how that event 10 years ago this week stimulated the EV industry, we get to this really ugly point now where the car makers feel that their reputations have been mended enough that now they can start pushing back on the 2035 clean air goals that regulators are putting in place. Oh yeah, so we've heard from BMW, Stellantis CEO Antonio Filosa, who took the helm in June this year, has called on the 2035 target to be labelled unrealistic, that was his word, urging for more flexibility for hybrid technologies to allow them to carry on making engines to avoid industrial decline in Europe. The pushback is not merely a debate over policy. It's an implicit admission that they can't do what the Chinese are doing. It's been forced, the industry was forced into a rapid and costly transition. Now they can't compete profitably against those that had an early advantage. That includes Tesla, and more significantly, the EV technology coming out of China that had a 20-year head start, by the way. The call is for flexibility to attempt to slow it down, slow the game, prolong combustion and hybrid technologies while we still hold that advantage, they argue, giving them more time to catch up. They threaten, of course, massive job losses and destruction of entire industries. Despite the high-stakes lobbying effort, the trajectory towards EV is irreversible. Amongst the fallout from Dieselgate, a tiny and highly unpopular podcast was launched on January the 16th, 2018. It wasn't particularly called anything clever. It was about EV news being presented daily by someone who was just becoming interested in the community. EV News Daily started on January 16th, 2018. It was a Twitter account for some time before that, but given my 20-year career in the broadcasting industry, I thought, well, I really should be podcasting. Actually, if it's the one thing that I know how to do, it's to do that. And so we're kind of heading towards 10 years of this podcast. And I think we're heading towards, well, I think we've, well, we're around 10 million downloads, but I don't really care. It's a vanity metric. Who cares? But I think we're ballpark 10 million downloads, right? So, you know, it's been a fantastic journey over the last 7+ years on this show to host this, to write it every single day, to chart the move of the automobile industry. I'm not an auto industry long-termer executive. I was an enthusiast. I still am an enthusiast. I don't know anything. But back in the day, I had a diesel Golf that was caught up in it. They went back to get the software reprogrammed. And on that day, I got the call to pick up my vehicle and they upsold me a service package. And so I emailed the dealer manager, who I knew tangentially through my business of working at the time in local radio. He was a big sponsor of a lot of the things that we did, a big client as well. And I explained my displeasure that you got caught doing something wrong, you have zero contrition, and that when you went, oh, your vehicle's now ready to pick up after we fixed it, admitting nothing that they did wrong, by the way. They weren't allowed to admit they did anything wrong in Europe. By the way, let's run you through the options that you can do to pay us some more money. I said, stop right there. And so I wrote him a letter and said, I think that at this point in time, although you can't say the words, we're sorry, because you can't admit you did anything wrong, now's not the time for the big hard sell. And he never replied. That's okay. I mean, I'm nobody. But I felt the need to communicate that. And I felt so angry towards Volkswagen and swore never to buy another one. I would now these days. That I don't stay angry at much for very long. But at the time, I was really annoyed. What an awful way to behave. And then to just use the opportunity of your car coming back to, like, sell me something. Like, no, today's not the day. And so from that moment in whenever that was, 2016, 2017, I super got into EVs. Became really interested in this. I wasn't a dad at the time. This is the future that I want to leave behind. And so this is what I want to dedicate my life to, is educating people about this stuff. The tens of billions of dollars and euros invested in EV platforms like VW's MEB, upcoming MEB Plus, SSP and more. The retooling of all the factories, the building of the battery gigafactories across Europe and North America, all the sunk cost is a monumental thing that can't be unwound. Don't be ridiculous. We're not going back to combustion. The CEOs live and die on 3 monthly targets. And when they're not met, as we see, even ones that are doing okay. Like, I think Stellantis, my American listeners think Stellantis is in the toilet because the brands that you get access to there, I agree. I have a different perspective over here. They make some very affordable cars in Stellantis. I thought they were doing okay. And against that backdrop, time for a new CEO. Look, CEOs are always going to argue for what they'll do what they have to do in that moment. So you can't, they're not bad people, but they're saying bad things at the minute. Consumer awareness has shifted. The 2035 target might be 2032. It might be 2037. We have to have a target. It might be subject to minor adjustments or not. But maybe they'll carve out some regulations around e-fuels or I don't know. But the target is set. We're not changing it. The legacy of Dieselgate doesn't lose any impact from what it did. It's still fresh. It's 10 years old, yeah, but it's profound and complex. And it was a necessary crisis that completely broke the industry's century-long inertia. It forced a transition that has to happen for climate change. Whether you believe in climate change or not, then it has to happen. The reactive, the nature of the pivot has been brutal. And I always try and remember that because I'm outside the industry looking in, and it's easy for me to say things sometimes, but it must be impossible because the compressed timescale that these companies are having to work to, it is industrial, it's economic, it's competitive challenges that I can't possibly imagine. The ultimate irony of Dieselgate remains the scandal born from a desperate attempt to sell more combustion cars resulted in a complete shift in the regulators and the market, and that mandates their complete elimination. The industry is now living in a future that in 2015, they forced upon it. So where do we go? Well, as the industry navigates its final decade, a clear and steady hand from both policymakers and corporate leaders, I believe, is required. I'll leave you a bit of editorial opinion stuff. You can ignore this last bit. It's just my thoughts. Number one, if you're a policymaker listening to this podcast, the massive private sector investments in EV have been made on clear, long-term regulatory signals. The people arguing right now for moving those goals are doing it because they have to do it right now to appease either a shareholder or a board, and you should ignore it. If you move on the core target of 2035, it creates market chaos. It jeopardizes the industrial competitiveness of continents, right? Europe's been doing this investment over the last 10 years. If you listen to these short-term arguments, trust me, China will eat your lunch. But you must address barriers. Policy support has to shift from stimulating demand to eliminating barriers. And there aren't many barriers left. So you must accelerate the deployment of reliable public charging everywhere. I'm a really big fan of regulating charging. It's because I worked my entire career from when I was 16, my first ever job in a regulated industry. The broadcast radio industry here is heavily regulated, and I worked within a tight set of boundaries, and that maybe that's to do with what you can say and the power of your transmitter and all those things. I'm just used to it. And it's because the FM frequency band and then digital was a scarce resource. So it needed regulating to ensure it wasn't abused. How we move around, how emergency vehicles get to where they're going to go, how you do your errands, how we physically, our industrial policy is governed by reliable charging. I think it's so serious. I do believe there should be more oversight of reliable charging. And for when charging is not reliable and you turn up to something that's broken or the cables have been cut, proper resources and policing is put into that to make sure that those people are brought to justice and that unreliable chargers are that those people don't get the chance to run charging businesses. It's not a popular viewpoint. This means accelerating also deployment of maybe more public infrastructure that subsidise, possibly, maybe policies to secure raw material supply chains for the car makers. That's what policymakers at those levels can do. They can use means-tested incentives to make entry-level EVs more affordable. I got money off my first two EVs that I bought back in the early days. I didn't need the money off it. I took it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not rich. But I wasn't somebody who couldn't still afford to have paid the full price. So for the industry, I know how difficult it is. You need to innovate and carry on innovating. Resources spent lobbying, hours spent arguing for moving dates and targets back. Use that time, invest that time in solving the challenges of electrification. The focus has to be on innovation to win in the new marketplace. Europe is about to get megawatt charging. BYD are rolling out a single cable 1,000 kilowatt charging for passenger cars. That's a Chinese company doing that. Why isn't that a European company? The next frontier of competition should be the affordable EV, particularly here in Europe, where a lot of built-up areas are physically older, smaller, more compressed. I live on a small island. Everything's compressed here, right? So we need more small cars. We must have the development and adoption of low-cost battery chemistries, lithium iron phosphate, sodium-based technologies, and solid-state batteries as well. Designing smaller, more efficient, less expensive vehicles. And as hardware becomes more commoditized, because that's what has happened, the key difference, I think they call them differentiators, the software. It's the experience you have of driving the car, how connected it is, the overall experience. So if you look at what's happening with, you know, the Volkswagen Rivian partnership, whether that recent reports that that's facing its own challenges, but those kind of initiatives are really smart, and that should be embraced in the industry, I think, to build, you know, in-house software. You can compete effectively, create that customer experience, because you can't really do it on making a slightly better motor or a slightly better battery. The road ahead is challenging for everyone, but the path is set and was set 10 years ago this week as we mark 10 years of Dieselgate. The legacy of Dieselgate is not one of scandal and failure. Let's forget that, right? It happened. It's in the books. Let's move forward. It is of transformation, breathing clean air, passing a planet on to the next generations that we're not totally ashamed of. It's put the automotive industry on a path towards a cleaner electric future. And we're not going back. That concludes Dieselgate 10. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on the next one.